Good morning, members. I'm calling the meeting of Energy and Climate to order. We do have a quorum. Representative Bierman, would you move the minutes from February 5th?
Yes, Madam Chair, I move that we move the minutes on the 5th.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposition? The minutes are approved. I am thrilled today that Ellen Anderson, who's the Executive Director of Energy Transition Lab, has arranged a great program for us today. Ellen, if you I want to call her Senator Anderson. If you would come up and bring your testifiers, we are ready to get started. We are now talking about the future and what storage means for our future.
Good morning, Madam Chair. Thank you so much for having us here today. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm Ellen Anderson. Great to be back at the Capitol. One of my prior offices was actually right here in this spot in a prior renovation, so it's fun to be here. I'm really delighted to be here to talk about energy storage and to really cover a broad swath of information and ideas about energy storage, and to also dig into the topic of equity in energy generally, in our energy systems, in our energy planning, and in energy storage in particular. So we have a great lineup of speakers, and so I'm just going to jump right in. I'm going to start with some opening comments. I'm not going to individually introduce each of our speakers. You all have their names, photos, and bios in your packets, so you can follow along in the same order. So I just want to give some opening comments to set the stage for today's topics and highlight a few key points about things that we have been working on. So the Energy Transition Lab at the University of Minnesota has been working on energy storage for a number of years. We've hosted two summits or conferences in the last couple of years, workshops. We founded the Minnesota Energy Storage Alliance, which now has its permanent home at the Clean Grid Alliance. And so just a little background on some of the things that we do. We have created this user-friendly handbook, Energy Storage 101, which you have a copy of in your packet, and there's more out front for those, for the members of the public, or if you want a color copy, let me know. and it has a glossary and user-friendly information and description of many storage technologies and functions. I also wanted to mention for your information, members, legislators, that we have, we're lucky enough to have an LCCMR grant related to energy storage, the Legislative Citizens Commission on Minnesota Resources, and that grant directs us to deploy three community-scale energy storage projects around the state and to use that, the learning from that experience, to develop a community-scale energy storage guide for people in Minnesota and the region. We really consider energy storage a game-changer in our energy systems, and that's been especially true in recent years with the fast growth of advanced battery technology. But we know that storage is more than batteries, and we'll get into that today. Since 2011, installed battery power capacity has almost doubled every 2 years in the United States, and prices have dropped significantly, and they're expected to continue dropping. And most of that growth and price reduction has been in the area of lithium-ion technology. But again, we'll hear about some other technologies today. You know, for many years, I've heard people say that energy storage is kind of the holy grail for renewable energy because it has the potential to really make renewable energy useful and dispatchable at any hour of the day or night, theoretically, so that intermittency becomes not a problem and makes it dispatchable for the grid. And that certainly may be true, especially as we begin to develop some other kinds of longer duration storage, that such as flow batteries, and to use some more traditional forms of energy storage like pumped hydro. There's lots of other kinds of storage that can be very good for that function of long-duration storage. But in particular, lithium-ion batteries and those advanced battery technologies are excellent at providing very fast responding services to the grid. And so one of the takeaways I think that's important today is that battery storage and storage generally can do so much more than support renewable energy integration into the grid. It has many, many other useful functions it can provide, and it's often most useful and most cost-effective when you can stack multiple functions. Fast-acting batteries can play a key role in providing ancillary services that the electric grid needs to function well, smoothing out fluctuations in generation, voltage, and frequency. Strategically located storage devices can help to ameliorate transmission constraints and congestion and can help to reduce curtailment or wasted renewable energy. And our evolving grid is going to be powered more and more by a diverse mixture of energy sources and types, and it will be spread out among a lot bigger geography than it has been in past years in our legacy system. And it will need to be more flexible and more nimble to be able to handle those all those different resources cost effectively and reliably. And there's a lot of functions that our legacy energy generators have provided, but often energy storage, it turns out, can do many of those functions better, faster, cleaner, and ultimately cheaper to enable our modern grid. So I just want to highlight one key example of an important energy storage potential use case. I'm not going to go into all the details. We have experts here who can do that more in more detail. But I want to talk just for a minute about peak demand, because this is something that we've spent a lot of time looking at the Energy Transition Lab. So you all probably know that electricity usage across the nation is relatively flat or even declining in many jurisdictions. But peak demand is actually increasing. And it's very expensive to manage peak demand. It takes a lot of peaking plants. Usually they're combustion turbine gas plants. A recent Massachusetts study found that 40% of the total electricity spending that consumers pay annually, 40%, which is over $3 billion in that state, was for only 10% of the most expensive hours of the year, of those peak hours of production. So in those really hot summer days when everybody's running their air conditioner and it's really hot, electricity is peaking, we spend a lot of money and a lot of resources to meet that peak demand. So our study looked at trying to use storage or a combination of storage and solar as an alternative to manage that peak demand. And what we found is that if you include the environmental benefits, that combination can be more a cost-effective alternative in Minnesota. And in other states, like California, it's being used to meet that need already. So also I want to mention another sort of geeky study that might be of interest to you. I was here on Tuesday for the hearing that the committee held, and there was some testimony about the McKnight report called Minnesota Smarter Grid. And I just wanted to point out one thing that wasn't brought up in that hearing about that report. That analysis was looking at how you could get to a 80% carbon reduction by 2050 in Minnesota under the Next Generation Energy Act goals. And that modeling report found that it would take 2,000 to 3,000 megawatts of energy storage in the state of Minnesota or in the region to support that conclusion or that outcome. So over the next few decades, it is essential if we're going to meet those goals and as we expand our renewable energy resource to expand our storage resource. So the main things we're going to have experts talk about today, as I mentioned, are the many use cases for storage, what are the most valuable functions storage can provide, and what are the economics behind those? What use cases are really cost effective? And we're going to hear from some people who actually have built projects. Also, we know that storage has many policy implications. And I don't want to talk too long about this. Just a couple of key points. One is that energy storage is so unique in our energy system. It's not technically generation of electricity, but it can inject electricity into the grid. It's not technically demand reduction, but it can take away load from the grid when it's needed. It's not transmission, but it can function in lieu of transmission in many cases. So those are just some examples where it doesn't fit into our traditional regulatory and policy rules and regimes. So it's really important for states, public utilities commissions, to get the rules right so that storage has the ability to compete effectively with other kinds of resources and be able to be as useful as possible to the grid. There's been a Federal Energy Regulatory Commission order, or FERC order, which I'm guessing one of the other speakers, probably Beth, will talk about, so I won't get into that. But there's a lot of change and evolution happening in those market rules as well at the regional grid level. And then two other things we want to talk about today besides those topics are research. What research is needed and what research is underway, and we're going to hear some of that from the University of Minnesota's Natural Resources Research Institute. Some of the things they're looking at, and we know there's a lot of other questions that research are needed to help to answer. How can we have more of that long duration storage? How can we avoid the use of toxic materials in storage and in batteries and improve those technologies? And how can we figure out how to use other kinds of storage like the batteries in electric vehicles or in school buses and inject some of those resources into the grid and connect them effectively? And finally, we're going to talk about energy equity. And I really appreciate, Madam Chair, your request to focus on that topic as part of this conversation, why it really matters to social justice, and as we transition our energy system to the future, how important it is to incorporate equity and inclusion and access to clean energy opportunities to a broader part of our population. And so we're going to talk about that as well and how that will play out. So let me stop there because I've already talked a lot and turn it over to our great speakers. We're going to start on my left with Brian Barrant from Conexus Energy, who I'll just say, because he's modest about this, has just finished installing the largest battery storage project in the state of Minnesota and in a big swath of the United States, and certainly the largest one that an electric co-op has ever done in the United States, as far as I know.
Just before he gets started, Representative Hornstein has a question for you.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, and thank you, Senator Anderson. I just thought, because of your introductory comments and you mentioned peaking issues, there's been so much discussion over the last week about, you know, energy reliability and the during the polar vortex, and, you know, op-eds and just a lot of public discussion even here around the Capitol. This just shows that renewables can't carry the load. And I'd be just, because you had brought it up, I thought it would be helpful to get your perspective on that specific thing, because, you know, we've really not heard, you know, maybe an alternative voice on that question.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Hornstein, I think that's a great question, and there has been a lot of discussion about it, and you're going to hear specifically from Brian Barrant about how Conexus's solar and battery storage project performed during the polar vortex, which I think is a really great example. I think generally there's a lot of confusion about what we need to get through a really cold period of time, and a lot of that is more focused on natural gas for heating, which is our primary source of heating fuel in Minnesota and a lot of the Midwest. And there's a lot of talk about wind and solar, but that doesn't really affect most people's heating capacity. So I think it's important just to remember that we have these kind of bifurcated systems, and we know that some of them are going to function really, really well, but there were gas constraints. And right now, during the coldest periods, there were gas constraints in the region for sure. And right now we use natural gas both for producing electricity and for heating our homes. And so those two uses are kind of competing with each other. And so if we can figure out ways to incorporate reliable renewable sources and a diversity of them, so it's not just wind and solar. If we include geothermal, if we include biomass, those are all part of our renewable energy resources. in the state of Minnesota under our laws, some of those can be dispatchable and complement each other and be very reliable in cold weather. So I think having a more diverse set of energy resources will help to address that problem. But I then will ask Brian to really fill you in more on that.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Welcome to the committee. If you just put your name on the record.
Good morning. I'm Brian Brandt with Kinexus Energy. In the next few minutes, I'm going to give a high-level overview as to how and why Kinexus added solar and batteries while reducing costs for our members. Everyone has seen pictures of solar installations, so this picture focuses on the battery enclosures to provide a visual as to the projects I'll be describing. Each white enclosure represents 1 megawatt of capacity with 2 megawatt hours. This is actually at our site in Anoka County. It's 6 megawatts with 12 megawatt hours connected to 4.5 megawatts of solar. As Ellen talked about, it just came online last month, so we have a full month of operation under our belt. Kinexus is a member-owned distribution cooperative of Great River Energy, more commonly GRE. We're a generation and transmission cooperative. The areas in gray represent the GRE member systems on the left. Kinexus is the largest of the 44 distribution cooperatives in Minnesota. We have over 135,000 members with a service area just over 1,000 square miles. Two-thirds of our members live within 30 miles of downtown Minneapolis-St. Paul. Our all requirements contract with GRE provides the flexibility to source up to 5% of our energy supply from renewables that are within our service area. The energy production from the 10 megawatts of solar is just under 1% of our annual sales, so we have some additional headroom. The 3 points in yellow are the key elements for the positive project financials. Megawatt scale is code for large enough for scale economies to benefit pricing. On the distribution grid means no transmission, interconnection, or use. Demand response design means that we will operate the battery when peak costs are the highest. The majority of each month, the solar systems will supply power directly to the grid. On probable peak days, we use the solar system to charge the batteries to time shift the delivery to our system peaks. The gray shaded area of this chart reflects the solar production, which is greatest midday when the sun is the highest. Our system peaks late afternoon as the sun is going down or already set. So we are using the batteries to align the solar production with our system peaks. We are time shifting energy produced in the gray shaded areas to the right to the green shaded areas. In summary, there are two primary value streams from this approach. Solar itself, when supplied directly to the grid, saves cost. Solar parked on a battery and then discharged during peaks saves cost. Over the next 6 months, we'll be validating the forecast. What we wish to say today is that we readily expect the economics to be more than a 25% savings relative to our baseline. The project is split between Athens Township and the City of Ramsey. All the generation from the Athens project will stay within the Athens Township and City of Isanti. All the generation from the Ramsey project will stay within the City of Ramsey. Nothing will be flowing onto the transmission system. These are distributed energy resource systems serving their local areas. NG is our solar developer and operator. The project is split based on the site acreage and interconnection capabilities. Combined, there are over 41,000 panels on 54 acres of land planted in pollinator habitat, with the annual energy production equivalent to the usage of 1,900 homes. The contract is a PPA, power purchase agreement, where we buy all the solar output at a fixed price for 25 years. NextEra is our battery developer and operator. Overall, the project has a ratio of 1 unit of solar to 1.5 units of storage. The battery technology is unique, given that they are lithium iron phosphate. They are in the lithium ion family, but slightly better for our demand response application. Combined, the projects have over 3,000 batteries on just over 1 acre of land, with the demand response equivalent to 6,700 homes. We have an energy storage agreement where we pay for energy storage services. It's a fixed rate for 25 years that allows for 75 cycles per year. A cycle is a full discharge and charge. The agreement is similar to valet parking. We pay a monthly fee to NextEra to park our electrons, and they return them at a later time. The batteries are integrated with the solar, so we will only give them solar electrons to park, thus allowing NextEra to monetize the investment tax credits by using renewables to charge the batteries. In return, the rate we pay is lower, as NextEra has included the ITC in the rate to us. To the question earlier, I often get, does solar work in Minnesota with the cold and the snow? As of last week, I have actual results to say yes, and specific to the polar vortex. On Wednesday, the coldest weather in 20 years, our project shed the snow and operated at an above-average level. Last Wednesday was declared by MISO as a maximum generation event for our region. This is a procedure to ensure system reliability by preparing all available generators to be dispatched in case of emergency. On average, it takes 1 to 2 days for the snow to clear after a storm. You can see in these photos that this, by Wednesday, 2 days after the snow rolled through Minnesota, the panels were about 98% clear, even though it was sub-zero temperatures. There is a correlation between the cold weather and sun. Typically, the coldest temperatures are on the days with clear skies with lots of sun for solar production. We began for this project 2.5 years ago. It started with a survey of our membership reflecting their interest for us to add more renewables, with the caveat that rates would not go up as a result. These survey results prompted us to take a hard look at batteries. Between the 2016 pro forma estimate and the 2018 contract execution with NextEra, the price of batteries decreased by 50%. I'll say that again, we are paying less than half of what we modeled in 2016 in the pro forma, and so far it's been working great.
There is a question from Representative Long.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for your presentation. This is a really exciting and path-breaking project for our state. Curious, you mentioned that the solar panels were performing better in cold weather. Is that typical? Is that something you've seen, that their performance goes up when it's colder temperatures?
It's not so much they perform better in cold weather, it's the fact that they performed well on Wednesday when it was 20 below zero. The fact that we had snow, 3 inches of snow on Sunday. Kinexus is a small company relative, so not only am I tasked with developing it, I'm tasked with the operation to make sure it does what I modeled it to do. So there was some stress. How quickly would the snow shed the panels so that we could charge the batteries back up? The batteries are left at a 50% state. So that means we need at least 15 megawatt hours per day to bring the batteries back to full state. And knowing it was cold back-to-back days, it was kind of a little stressful to make sure that we could have enough sun to recharge the batteries, and we did. So the first month out of the gate, we had some challenging conditions, and the batteries and the solar worked well.
Thank you, Madam Chair. There's been some discussion among some of our committee members who aren't here about capacity factors. Do you have an estimate for what your capacity factor is at this point?
Solar overall for the 8760 hours per year, it's about 15%.
Great. And since it seems like your project is performing even better than your projections, are you planning to look into potentially other solar or storage projects in the future?
Good question. We are. We'll be adding another 5 to 7 megawatts of solar this year. We have flexibility to add more energy supply, but within that renewable flexibility, we've already hit our contractual maximum in terms of what we could do with storage. To some of Ellen's comments, it would be helpful if there was clear definition statute what storage really is. Some of the G&Ts are taking the position that storage is generation, and therefore is precluded under an all requirements contract.
Thank you.
Representative Baker.
Madam Chair, thank you. Thanks for the presentation. A couple of questions I have. I think I heard that GRE is one of your partners, maybe the owner of this project. Is that correct?
GRE is our generation and transmission company. Kinexis is a member-owned utility, and in turn, we are a member owner of GRE.
Okay. And Madam Chair, 75 cycles. Was that 75 cycles in a year?
Correct.
Or that you basically can fully charge them, use 50%, bring it back up to full charge, do that 75 times in a year? Is that kind of what that was saying?
That is correct. But for clarity, we'll bring the batteries up to 30 megawatt hours, and we'll discharge all 30 megawatt hours. The sizing between solar and batteries was to accommodate back-to-back days, which we had last week, Tuesday and Wednesday, to bring the batteries up to full charge, discharge, and then have enough solar resources the next day to bring the batteries back to full charge again. That's why it's a little unique in that ratio. A lot of the benefit is in the storage, and solar is the enabler to get the ITC on the batteries.
Okay, and Madam Chair, also I think I heard the solar costs have been kind of agreed to for the next 25 years. We've been hearing that continually drops and drops and drops. Are you concerned that, and maybe you want to share with what is that rate, if that's public information, what is that agreed to? Because as we hear, we are excited to hear solar is dropping and cheaper all the time. I think this technology's, I mean, goodness, the batteries are half the price. That's great news. What does that look like then for locking that in for such a long time, being an old commission member of the Willmar Municipal Utilities and negotiating rates with our friends at GRE and others? I just know that there's changes out there. So what makes you most maybe nervous or optimistic about the good plan of locking in solar for the next 25 years?
Solar today is 10% less than what we would pay alternatively. Solar interconnected at the distribution grid foregoes the need to buy some transmission services, especially in the summertime, as well as capacity services. The view of our board, it makes sense today. The PPA is a risk mitigation model that if something goes awry, we're not on the hook. We only buy the energy it produces. And we feel confident that this was a good deal, especially coupled with the batteries. The batteries more than doubled the project cost, but took the economics from a 10% savings to more than a 25% savings.
And final question, Madam Chair. The savings or the expense down the road, it sounds like those numbers are being processed, and I think you're going to find some real numbers here soon. Will that be shared on a larger grid, or is that pretty much just with your company, Kinexis? Is that kind of locked in there, or will that be shared with others?
It'll be rolled into the rates. It's an alternative power supply arrangement. A cost of service-based business, as you know from the Willmar experience, it's lowering our power supply, so all Kinexis members will be benefiting from these projects.
Thank you.
Yes. Representative Bowe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You mentioned a couple of times the advantages of being able to produce and distribute within the distribution grid and avoiding the cost of going out into transmission lines. I had heard something about that recently changes had occurred and that advantage of staying off the transmission lines was either reduced or eliminated, but I can't recall the details. But some of the communities I know were making plans at one time to have either peak generating or just generating plants built in the community, but then that the financial advantage to that disappeared. Are you familiar with what changed, and can you maybe help me understand what, as a legislature, we could do to make that more advantageous again, to allow you to stay off of the transmission grid and just produce and use within the system?
Well, not only I'm not aware of the example you're talking about specifically, but through our contractual obligations to Great River Energy, the power has to be generated locally within our service area. It can't flow back onto the transmission grid, and it can't exceed more than 5% of our monthly demand to them. The advantage of having a distributed energy resource, the power stays local, that when the solar, in the summertime especially, is still in play when we're peaking, so it avoids the need to buy transmission services just by the sheer load shape reduction, and the same with capacity.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to find out more details about that, and I'll share it with the committee when I get that, so thank you.
Last question from Representative Bierman before we go on.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Brian, maybe I missed it, but did you say how long energy can actually just sit in these batteries before it's transmitted?
For maximum longevity of the batteries, they rest at 50%. They don't like to bring the batteries up to full charge for more than 48 hours.
48 hours, thank you. And a follow-up on that is, where are the batteries produced?
These batteries came from China.
From China, okay. And lastly, please, Madam Chair, how many other projects are there in the state of Minnesota that are as large as this project that are ongoing? Is this one of many, or are you a leader in this field here?
There are no other battery projects in the Midwest of this size.
Thank you. Your next testifier.
Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Beth Sohold. I'm Executive Director of Clean Grid Alliance. You have my presentation in your packet. I'm going to take us back a little bit to policy, and the role of Clean Grid Alliance has been to be a regional nonprofit advocacy organization really focused on how we're going to integrate renewable energy into the grid. We have worked with utilities on technical issues, engineering issues, project implementation as we bring on wind and solar resources, and looking more and more at what combination of resources can affordably and reliably serve Minnesotans going forward. We know that utilities have needs out in the late 2020s or 2030s, and there's much discussion going on about what is going to serve that need. So unlike some of the NGOs you hear from in this committee, we are a regional, we work regionally. And so we have a grid operator that operates in 15 states. We cover 9 of those states working on public policy and on working on projects. We have extensive participation kind of on the technical issues at MISO, the Mid-Continent Independent System Operator. And we do work with utilities extensively on their integrated resource plans and are encouraging them to look at storage with combinations of resources, look at the values and benefits they could get from adding storage with new generation resources, both on the at the distribution level and on the bulk transmission system level. So let me just talk through a few of my slides. You heard from Brian a very case-specific example of energy storage and solar. This slide really takes you from soup to nuts on the various applications for storage. It can be in front of the meter or behind the meter. It can be with bulk grid operations. It could be at the transmission and distribution system that the state regulates, or it can be at the customer level, which is kind of more of the end use level. And so the blessing and the curse about storage is that it can be many different things. And so the difficulty is figuring out what do we want to do with storage? You know, what's the best and highest use? What should we ask customers to pay for? What kinds of savings can they see from implementing storage with renewables, for example? And so you'll hear from Dan in a little while, who's a developer and can work with utilities and customers to really figure out what values and what end uses that they could maybe supply a storage application for. So again, lots of policy discussion around what's the appropriate role for the state to incent and encourage storage, what rules, kind of we call them the rules of the road, what kind of rules need to be put in place to allow storage to provide value to the grid and to provide services, get revenue, and how do we count that kind of into our overall portfolio? So let me just talk about several drivers for storage in Minnesota right now. I've already mentioned that utilities have resource needs that are driving them to look at new combinations of things, new natural gas, what to do with nuclear units long term, looking at some dates certain for retiring coal plants. All those moving pieces come with the need to replace that existing power. And so our role with our colleagues is to encourage utilities to take a more systematic look at opportunities for storage in Minnesota that are going to benefit ratepayers. Can they hold off constructing upgrades at a distribution substation? Can they not build a transmission line but still facilitate with storage transmitting resources on the bulk electric system? So until we really take a hard look in a significant planning process that the utilities undergo every couple of years to look at their needs, we really don't know what the best and highest use of storage, particularly combined with generation, is going to be. And so there are bills out there that encourage utilities to do more in the planning process, specifically looking at storage. Utility customers are increasingly asking for clean energy. And so as part of a supply on the distribution side, pairing renewables with storage, what are the appropriate uses? Like we've heard with Kinexis, saving money, 25% below what they would have to buy power for at today's prices. So people are looking at what are the cost-saving opportunities. And then there's a lot of work being done on microgrids or grid resilience issues. We have loads that are very sensitive at hospitals, at schools, manufacturing, in a lot of different applications, and pairing storage at some of these locations with a microgrid might serve these sensitive loads well. So lots of drivers, and again, we have to figure out what's the role of policy in incentivizing some of these and moving some of these drivers forward. So I just wanted you to make you aware of some work that's currently underway at the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission. So we have a number of initiatives that are underway. Right now, the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission is updating their interconnection standards with utilities and other stakeholders. Those interconnection standards that are important to timely and orderly and cost-effectively getting new resources on the grid, that will apply to storage up to 10 megawatts. And so that's an important undertaking at the PUC. The PUC is also working with utilities to do distribution planning, to really integrate and look at what is coming on the distribution side of the grid. That traditionally has been less than transparent in utility resource planning. So utilities might just reduce their need or reduce their demand to account for resources on the distribution side. But now the PUC is asking them to take a finer look at how are we planning for resources on the distribution side? What do we expect will be interconnected in the coming years? And to take a more comprehensive look at how distribution resources fit into the planning process. And then finally, I believe it was Ellen mentioned the order at the federal level that FERC, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, issued a while back, Order 841. This applies to resources that are connected on the bulk transmission system, but it also goes down to a 100 kW. Applies to resources down to 100 kW. And so the order really requires regional transmission operators and independent system operators, the kind of the air traffic controllers of the grid, to look at changing their tariffs so that they can get storage that is eligible to provide capacity, energy, ancillary services, so that they up, update their tariffs to allow storage to provide those services. And there's much work going on at MISO these days. They did make a compliance filing in December that kind of was a culmination of their first year of discussion about how they're going to allow storage to come in on the grid. I would say it's a first step in talking about how they're going to allow storage to participate in the MISO market. I think there are lots of other coming opportunities for Minnesota Resources to participate in the regional energy grid, but that's going to take more work on the rules and the policies and projects, more conversation with utilities about how they want to use storage in combination with other resources in the bulk market in the region. I will stop there, and Madam Chair, glad to take questions.
I don't see any questions right now, so why don't we go on to our next testifier, because we want to make sure everybody gets in here.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Dan Foley. I'm the CEO of GlidePath Power. We're an IPP developer, very similar, but in much smaller size as NG or NextEra. GlidePath, we've developed four 20-megawatt battery projects that are in operation in Illinois. We also own, or will own, pending a regulatory approval, 450 megawatts of wind, solar, and batteries in the U.S. We currently have a 20-megawatt project that we're operating in, or will be operating pending regulatory approval in Pennsylvania. Early on in my career, I was a dispatcher with ComEd, and so I have an appreciation for some of the reliability issues that you go through in terms of balancing generation and load. I worked 2 years of nights while I was going to school to get my MBA. But I definitely have an appreciation for those situations. And when we as developers approach different situations, we do that from a resiliency and a reliability perspective, and definitely have the kind of utility reliability background when we come at it. In terms of why you would want third parties to participate in battery development, there's three reasons. One is technology risk. We're really not sure where exactly the technology is going. It's very exciting, though. It's like you're looking at like the old green wall phone with the cord on it that my kids don't even know exists, and going to something like this. I can't tell you what this is going to be in the industry, but it is really exciting. You can see the technology. You can see between the microgrids and batteries and distributed generation and where prices are coming with solar panels and wind and even some of the gas technology. It's really exciting. But the technology risk, by using third parties like an NG or a NextEra, you can push a lot of that technology risk off on the developer, not on the rate base. The other issue is operational risk. We were talking about 75 cycles, right? Sometimes if the contracts are structured right, we can go more than 75. We can push that, right? And that risk will be on us, right? Not on the utility, not on the rate base. The third reason is cost of capital. There is a lot of money sitting on the sidelines right now, and some of you may not be aware of this, but PPAs, or power purchase agreements, with 35-year offtake agreements that provide a lot of certainty, there's folks that will do that for about a 5% return, right? So the cost of capital, and by doing that for such a low return, it lowers the prices to all the customers, right? 5% cost of capital is ridiculously low, but that translates back through because there's so many of us out there competing for that PPA, it drives the price way down. So I think the question is, how do you encourage third-party developers to participate in Minnesota's market? Now, we recently opened up an office near U of M, and we have three employees. We're probably going to double that in the next year. We're looking at battery storage. We have identified probably 15 to 20 sites in Minnesota. What we need is a well-defined revenue model. We need to know how we're going to get paid for it. Right. Obviously, my cohort here, they gave NG and NextEra an offtake agreement, provided that certainty. It was clear how they were going to get paid. The second piece is transparency and efficiency in the interconnect. We want to be able to get through the interconnection process quickly. We need to understand how that works. And we've heard that the commission is looking at improving the interconnection process. And finally, the thing is, we need certainty in the interconnect. We need to know when we'll be interconnected and how much it'll cost, right? What that does is it translates back, again, to the lower cost of capital for us. We can manage a lot of risks as developers, operational, technology, construction risk. We do that all day long. The regulatory risk of having a cost overrun on an interconnected node control is a problem. But those are really the three things that Texas did so well to get the penetration of renewables in the market. Those were the interconnection certainty and cost, and then the access to so many offtake agreements, which gave us the cost certainty. Those were the things that drove most of the developers down there. So with that said, there was one question about the costs and why munis and co-ops weren't building behind the meter again. That has to do with the MISO tariff and the transmission allocation and the methodology. And if you want to, I can contact your office and tell you exactly what's going on. But it's not settled. It's really something that needs to go to FERC. But thank you so much for your time. It's very this industry is very exciting. We will get here from that pea green wall phone soon.
Thank you. Representative Long has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This question is either for Ms. Holt or Mr. Foley. Talking about some of the accelerations of technology and price coming down, there was a pretty exciting bid in Colorado this year with the 275-megawatt storage project. The quotes I saw were ridiculously low prices, unprecedented low prices. What are we seeing in terms of trends for prices? And if you want to comment on the Colorado project or others that you're seeing in terms of how quickly we might see some of this size project integrating.
So right now, the problem we have is that we're competing with the auto industry. We do project that the battery prices are going to be coming way down. We see a lot of capacity that's being built in Asia, and we're seeing some of the higher-end battery technologies coming into the U.S. I'm going to throw out some numbers. They're more ballpark numbers, but in 2006, we probably saw panel prices at like around $200 a watt. You know, now you're looking at about 32 to 35 cents a watt. We're probably like 2009 in batteries, where when we built our first four projects, we were at about $400 a kilowatt hour for batteries. We're probably below 200. The expectation is by 2020, 2021, we'd be under $100. In order to compete with a gas peaker, we need to be under $100 a kilowatt hour for storage.
And Madam Chair, Representative Long, I would just say that anecdotally for the Xcel bids in Colorado, we heard that a lot of developers were adding storage to their bids as kind of a loss leader to get some experience with operating storage on the Xcel system. And so we hope that Xcel would try something with that like that here, because we think they'd get the same market response. And so we're kind of waiting for them to do an RFP for something similar. Again, it goes back to what do they need, but we expect that the marketplace will react very robustly when there is an opportunity. So it will be very cost effective.
Yeah, go ahead, and then I have a comment. Yeah.
So one of the other things that we've seen is that the lithium technology has been for transport, so you want it nice and light, right? For the utility scale stuff, we don't. It's stationary. And so we don't want to be paying that premium for lightweight. We don't necessarily need the power density. And so that's the other that's kind of the next wave of technology that we're going to see are batteries that are specifically for stationary applications and not pay the premium for the lightweight.
And, excuse me, Madam Chair, on the, on the Colorado example and Representative Long, one other thing I wanted to mention about that is that Colorado has a regulatory mechanism called the Innovative Clean Technology, ICT mechanism, through their Public Utilities Commission, that it allows utilities like Xcel to
get approval for innovative pilot projects that are using new technology. And that helps to reduce the risk somewhat for the utility to embark on that. And it's allowed them to go through the process of approval. They have to show that you will really learn some valuable things from these projects that will benefit ratepayers eventually or ultimately and benefit the grid system. And then they can be approved by the commission. And that really helped them go forward in Colorado. And we don't have anything like that in place in Minnesota. Sorry, cold that never ends.
That was an important thing to bring up. I'm glad you mentioned that. I think we are ready to go for your next group of testifiers.
Wonderful, thank you. So, Madam Chair,
thank you so much for coming. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having
me. Thank you. Dr. Cecilia Martinez, Jimenez Staples, and Dr. Rolf Weberg.
Just start with your name. Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Cecilia Martinez, and I am the executive director of a nonprofit organization called the Center for Earth, Energy, and Democracy here in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Our nonprofit organization focuses on energy and climate policy, and more specifically, we deal with equity and social and environmental justice on climate and energy issues. So my testimony today is going to focus on equity issues with respect to energy in the state of Minnesota and nationally, and how we might use this opportunity for new energy technologies to address some of the fundamental problems that we see among our most vulnerable populations in the state and in the country. As we continue to invest in innovative and advanced energy technologies, it's imperative that we consider how the benefits and the costs of these technologies will impact all residents of Minnesota. In nearly every other sector, whether it be housing or education, transportation, it is understood that the public responsibility to enhance the quality of life of all residents, and especially the most vulnerable, is crucial. Unfortunately, historically in this country, energy systems planning and regulation has not necessarily incorporated these issues of equity and is now beginning to do so, which we are very glad to see. Yet the problem of historical and the future problem of disparate and inequitable impacts of the energy system continue to be clearly evident in the realities of many of our communities. And this has manifested itself in a number of ways. First is the problem of energy burden, that is the ability to have access to affordable energy for a healthy home. According to data published by the U.S. Energy Information Agency, we have the following problems in this country. Nearly one-third of U.S. households reported facing a challenge in paying energy bills or sustaining adequate heating and cooling in their homes. About 2 in 5 households reported reducing or foregoing necessities such as food and medicine to pay an energy bill. 14% reported receiving a disconnection notice for energy service, and 11% of households reported keeping their home at unhealthy or unsafe temperatures. When research on specifically low-income households is even more stark, 24% of low-income households have gone without food for at least one day to pay energy bills, 37% without medical or dental care, and 34% did not fill a prescription or took less than their appropriate dosage. Moreover, public programs to address the problem of energy insecurity are severely underfunded and do not even begin to address this situation. At its peak, the Low-Income Home Energy Assistance Program, or LIHEAP, served only 21% of eligible households. A second problem with regard to equity and energy planning is, as we all know, the problem of pollution mitigation and the need to produce energy with as minimal pollution as possible. This includes not only carbon and greenhouse gas mitigation to address the problem of climate change, it also includes other pollutants such as NOx, SOx, and particulate matter, all of which are also byproducts of fossil fuel combustion and have very localized health effects on communities. For that reason, we believe an equity consideration in energy planning is to prioritize new energy technologies such as energy storage to address pollution mitigation specifically. We would assert that implementing energy storage should have lower environmental impact. Otherwise, it truly does not make sense if the substantial energy investments of today continue to sustain an energy infrastructure that will have negative investments. This is of critical importance in communities that already have the burden of legacy pollution. An MIT study recently found that over 200,000 premature deaths occur every year due to air quality issues. And even when in regulatory compliance, some communities face unhealthy conditions. Lastly, who gets the benefit of ratepayer subsidized investments is an issue of fairness. For example, behind the meter and community-based energy source systems are an important resiliency issue, particularly for communities with limited resources to withstand natural or man-made disasters or severe weather events. In combination with the issues noted above of pollution mitigation and energy insecurity, pilot projects and priority investments that target disadvantaged communities, whether they be urban or rural, is an important fairness issue. As energy storage projects around the country emerge, most of the economic benefits of storage are now realized by commercial utility customers who are saving money from these systems through electricity bill reductions. But very few projects have been located in disadvantaged communities. Ironically, these low-income customers need the benefit of solar and battery storage systems the most. So our advocacy and policy must be directed to include and ensure that these communities benefit from these technologies. In our view, there are a number of ways in which that can happen in Minnesota. And as we move forward in energy policy regulation and investment, we recommend three major pathways forward. One is the development of metrics that can address both the important technological energy issues, energy system impact issues, but also the social and health benefits that may occur from energy storage. That appropriate analysis and an evaluation of these co-benefits also be incorporated into the future work of these technologies. And that lastly, that we begin to develop pilot projects that are targeted at disadvantaged communities to begin to see, get some lesson learned, get some practical evidence-based understanding of how we might target this technology to build both the resilience of these communities and reduce the energy burden that they face. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Next testifier.
Oh, sure. Madam Chair, thank you and committee. My name is Jamez Staples. I'm the president of Renewable Energy Partners, a social enterprise, which is focused on making sure that people of color in North Minneapolis and other parts of the city actually have the opportunity to participate in the emerging sectors, such as solar installation, as well as energy storage projects. It's imperative that we make sure that equity is a key component, making that energy storage has the positive impacts for low-income and disadvantaged communities. Just as my colleague here mentioned, as a resident of North Minneapolis, we bear a lot of the negative impacts of poor air quality. And what's important is that we, not only just in North Minneapolis, but also throughout the state of Minnesota, that we actually participate and have the share the benefits of these emerging technologies as they're developed. Working with Ellen Anderson here and the Energy Transition Lab, we were awarded one of the three batteries that's going to be sponsored by the LCCMR committee to support a training center, which will be developed in North Minneapolis by a sister company of mine, Northgate Development. And through that training program, through that facility, we'll have a 155-kilowatt system of solar on the roof. We'll have that battery from the Energy Transition Lab. as well as electric vehicle charging stations and stormwater management systems, which will be implemented on site. This will be a site where we actually start to implement some of these climate change mitigation factors and help students understand the importance of these emerging technologies. Sorry. The goal here is, for me, is to make sure, like I said, is that we're making sure that we do not leave communities behind. And I'll conclude because my notes are messing up.
Madam Chair,
Before you start, Representative Christensen has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, panel, very much. A question about pilot projects. Have other states, are there other states that we can look to for, for us to move forward? Are we the leader? are there other states that have done something similar that we could look to? Thank you.
From an equity perspective, and most likely because of the significant work that environmental justice and equity organizations have done in California, there is significant work in California around pilot projects and how to integrate policy legislation and regulation into that. So that would be one state. I believe also New York is also another state where some work is being done and progress is being done on this.
Thank you.
You want to continue with, would you like to come on?
Madam Chair, Representatives, and Senator Anderson, I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to talk about a little bit of a pivot looking future, because I think it's very important to look at where we have been this morning, looking at the state of the art, some of the exciting things we're talking about, and then the social aspect of energy. And I think as we look to the future technology and research really has to be the product of both. And that's part of what I wanted to talk about today. For those of you that aren't 100% aware of what NRI is, other than four letters, NRI was created in 1983 by the legislature to foster development of Minnesota's resources in a way that was sustainable, that created jobs. So it's a bit of everything. It's a responsibility. It's how do we use resources and how do we have resilient communities. And that's what we focus on. NRI has two industrial-sized sites, 120 full-time researchers, up to 40 students and temporary researchers that work on these kinds of projects. We're a non-academic unit, but we are an integral part of the research enterprise at the University of Minnesota. We joke that our job is to take technology kicking and screaming out of the lab and find a way to apply it to commercialization and or providing information and tools for good, sound, long-term decisions. So that's a little bit, in a real nutshell, what we're about and what we're here to do. We don't do our work by ourselves. We have broad collaborations and broad relationships with industry, NGOs, obviously academics, as well as government and agencies, both in the state and in the country. So what we prepared today was a quick overview of what are we doing and what some of our future focal points are. NRI's had a 35-year history of looking at energy opportunities, and you can see in the first part of the conversation, the one sheeter that I provided. There's been a lot of work in mineral process optimization. If you've been in a mine ever, there's a lot of energy that gets used. There's about 30 years experience understanding how heat flow works in big operations, and when you look at that kind of energy utilization, 1% makes a difference. We have a long-term program in biomass conversion to high-value products, not just fuels, but also high-value carbon products that sequester carbon. And we also have had a long-term renewable energy storage effort that in the last 3 years, there have been four major reports in combination with state agencies, the University of Minnesota, notably the St. Anthony Falls Labs, to create scenarios for where you could do pump hydro in the state of Minnesota. There's two reports on that. Compressed air energy storage using our landscape features, as well as full characterization of the geothermal opportunities in Minnesota, which unfortunately are fairly low. Part of that, you can see the first two pictures, the idea of pump hydro is pumping water uphill. and letting it flow back through a turbine as you would for a battery, similar where I moved from in Buffalo, New York. There is basically a big tank underground where you fill it with air and let it out again when you want to release that energy you're storing. It's a way to basically another way to store. What we're talking about here is really a portfolio approach. It's not either or. It's having a portfolio of solutions is the way you drive real solutions. Currently, we are working on generally three similar areas. We've driven into an advanced compressed air energy model, and I'll spend the rest of the time talking about that. And all of these are driven by engagement with companies from across the country. We are working on several new battery technologies that could be manufactured in the United States that find different ways to use some of the mineral resources here in Minnesota to make batteries and battery technology that would be simpler. I can say that much. Most of this work is covered by non-disclosure agreements, and I have to be careful about how far I go with that. We're also engaged with a number of companies across the country in how do we make smarter decisions about how do we use our biomass not only for high-value liquid fuels, but also for carbon storage. And we can talk about that in another venue. But as we look at energy and energy storage and electrification of our transportation system, we're still going to need high-quality liquid fuels for jet aircraft and heavy-duty equipment. So focusing on the second page of the handout, the advanced compressed air energy storage is something we're working on. I thought I'd spend a few moments talking about that to give you a feel for where that technology is going. We've heard about the battery technology today. This is a result of an engagement with a Canadian company we've been working with for the last 3.5 years, looking at possibilities of using landscape assets we would have here in Minnesota to have bulk storage, big storage of energy. Does not preclude batteries at all. It's part of the package. But it's really relevant when you start talking about storage in the scale of MISO. It's also relevant when you start talking about some of the landscape features we have, particularly in the northern and central part of the state, where we have pit lakes and we have underground workings that are either in process or are legacy aspects of the mining industry. When you look at an idea of storing energy with compressed air, this advanced compressed air is kind of the best of both worlds of taking pump hydro and combining it with compressed air. So in essence, if you look at the picture on the right, upper right, where you have a lake or a water reservoir, could be a pit reservoir. Some of those are 800 feet, 900 feet deep. And you have underground workings underneath it that you can flood, and you simply use your compressed air to push the air back to the surface, and then you've got that head of water once you push back down that runs your generators. It's been demonstrated around the world by this company that we're engaged with at 300 to 500 megawatt size. It's a big bulk storage unit. And this is an interesting opportunity for the state of Minnesota to take assets that we aren't currently using and putting them into use in a large bulk storage fashion. So that gives you an idea, and the two pictures on the bottom just give you an idea of some of the extensive, the understanding that NRI and our partners have of what these underground workings look like and how you might be able to use these assets that are under the ground right now as an energy storage capability. So this is forward-looking. It's what kinds of possibilities are out there, but it's also understanding everything from the costs associated with it, the benefits from getting benefit out of land that is not used right now, as well as understanding how that impacts the communities and opportunities for the state. So I'll stop there.
Representative Long has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The question's for Mr. Staples. We heard on Tuesday from the McKnight Foundation that if we move aggressively on renewable energy, we could create 50,000 jobs in Minnesota in the wind and solar industries. And I'm curious on what you think are some of the barriers to making sure that all of our communities can participate in the clean energy economy.
Thank you for the question, Madam Chair. Thank you for the question, Representative Long. There's a huge opportunity, as we all know, in the solar energy industry. Minnesota is one of the 8 states that the solar installation job is the fastest growing job. To make sure that there's active participation by all communities, it's imperative that access to training as well as necessary components to require participation by the participants that go through those training programs. I think that when we move in this direction of a clean energy economy, we need to be cognizant of the fact that we can address climate change and poverty at the same time. So by creating those pathways for opportunities, there's a huge opportunity. I'm sorry to keep using that word, but it's just so robust that we make sure we capitalize on that as a state to also contribute to our tax base and get more people off the bench.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Dr. Martinez, you were talking a little bit about the needs in the low-income home energy assistance program and how many low-income customers don't get help for their heating bills. Are there models or pathways that you think would be best for us to consider for how to help low-income households get better access either to clean energy or to better energy efficiency for their homes?
Yes, thank you. Representative, Madam Chair, I think alongside what Jemez has indicated, I think one of the problems that we've had is that there's difficulty, the research is very sparse in terms of how the systems themselves operate and where the barriers to access are. So obviously one primary opportunity is employment expansion and employment of our underemployed and unemployed community members to be able to have a livable wage in order that this doesn't become a problem. I think also that there are ways in which we can, particularly for this technology and behind the meter, begin to look at how to integrate these types of technologies into affordable housing. And other kinds of distribution DG efforts, community solar, as Jemez's projects are trying to show, and in a way that targets those communities in a way to provide to incentivize industry to actually locate there, because we have the problem, obviously, where these communities, it's not as economically beneficial for the private sector to develop their programs there, and so we do need public support and incentivizing in order to address those needs.
Excuse me, Madam Chair, if I can just sort of follow up on both of those comments. There's a couple of examples that you may be aware of. One is, as Dr. Martinez mentioned, and Jemez's project with a community solar garden. Well, you can explain it better than I can.
Sure, maybe I'm sorry. Yeah. So, Madam Chair, we're working on a variety of community solar gardens in low-income communities, and one of them is on the rooftop of North High School. Making sure that community solar garden is actually being subsidized. Not subsidized, the city of Minneapolis is the anchor subscriber, making sure that if there's any fallout from any low-income participants, that there's a backup subscriber to absorb those subscriptions. And that is a model to follow, because ultimately we're helping the public schools, which is the second entity to be a anchor subscriber, which will help them save on their energy usage, as well as create the opportunity for students to also be engaged and understand how this energy sector works and how it can benefit and help mitigate climate change. And also, one of the key components of this is that we want to make sure that students are very familiar and aware of not just solar, but also the other energy components that help to mitigate climate change. What's happening is that we have a workforce shortage in the state of Minnesota, and I'm sure everybody's pretty aware of that. Well, if we do a better job of making sure that our high school students are getting the necessary career and technical education, which we're seeking to do through this training center in North Minneapolis, as a centralized location, it's more efficient use of funds by centralizing training in one location, and at the same time, it's also creating awareness around these sectors and opportunities that we're missing the mark on.
So, Madam Chair, if I can just add one more point. In addition to the kind of community solar model that Jemez mentioned, where, the low-income customers will see real bill savings, There's a program run by REAL in rural Minnesota that you may be aware of that is trying to use existing energy LIHEAP funding or weatherization funding, that it, you know, existing funding streams from the federal government to be allowed to use that to install solar space heating systems onto the homes of or apartments of low-income residents, so that, again, instead of just trying to use the funding once to pay off a bill, it's being used to install equipment that will help to reduce their overall heating load and increase the quality of, you know, health impacts in their within their home. And so it's more of a long-term solution, and it's taking some real innovation to get there, but I think it's moving forward.
Madam Chair. Yes. One other project that we've worked on in conjunction with the Energy Transition Lab, we went out to the Rocky Mountain Institute Electricity Innovation Lab in Sundance Resort, and we basically have proven a model which we can ultimately utilize public buildings for the purposes of implementing microgrid and storage capacity. It's along the what I've branded as the East Plymouth Innovation Corridor project, which is it's kind of a brainchild of my own, so don't Google it, it's not going to pop up. But we're working with the Minneapolis Public Schools on their nutrition center site on Plymouth Avenue. Just north of that building is Franklin Middle School, and just further north of that is Hall Elementary. And what the ultimate plan is to do is to implement a microgrid storage project with solar as a production, and also utilizing some of the existing legacy gas-powered gas mechanisms as a microgrid project. And the participants that went along with us to this ELAB exercise was a representative from Xcel Energy, someone from the mayor's office, Ellen came from the University of Minnesota, myself, two of my colleagues that work with me, and a Minnesota State Commissioner, and Open Access Technology International. So they are a big microgrid firm, and we proved this model that it could ultimately work, and it would serve twofold. It would serve as a mechanism also for students to learn from, but also as a component for a resilience strategy. If the city, like in North Minneapolis in 2011, we had a tornado, all the power was out. And that site right there specifically has a food hub where they produce all the breakfasts and lunches for the school system. So if anything were to happen like that again, ultimately we have a space where community members can come and charge their phones, and the systems could be back up and running within power, at least power at those buildings could be utilized within 24 hours.
Representative Baker has a question.
Just maybe a comment too, Madam Chair. And again, this has been a very enlightening week to kind of understand the new technology that is out there, and it's robust, and it's still early development, and I appreciate that. Again, members have heard me say this before, that I, as I sat on the commission back in Wilmer, to really fight for and try to dive into clean, reliable, and affordable energy is really important. I think the one component this week that, we kind of missed a little bit on is that affordable component, because I don't know that we know all these numbers yet. To Mr. Staples' point, too, great presentation. And I think that what I continually go towards is helping those communities of need. They cannot have their electric rates go up. And yet, when Member Christensen asked the question about other states' ideas, California comes up, well, they're double what our rates are. We have to just always remember that, and there's a balance here. And so I'm concerned about our grid system is going to be our choking point if we can't move energy and different sources coming on the grid. Great presentations. But I am scared, and I'm nervous that the rates that I was fighting so hard to keep low, and I also sit on HHS finance, so we're putting out fires because of health concerns, and we're helping elderly, we're helping folks with rent credits and housing and SNAP fitness, benefits. But I'm telling you, this is a big part of our discussion here must always be the real cost of energy and the real cost of the new ideas without the subsidies. But we just have to make sure we remember that through this important session, and I just want to make sure that that always is part of our conversations. Because again, I love this technology, I love what's coming. We have to make sure the system and our grid and our customers can afford to pay what my fear is might be coming. So just with that, it was more of a statement. Madam Chair, thank you.
Representative Moe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Two quick questions, if I may. The first is for Dr. Weber, and that is, you know, the discussion of mechanical means for storage. I like that concept, and I know the line gets a little blurred between, is it storage of energy, or is it storage of material that allows us to produce energy at a later time? But either way, it's a storage that allows us to produce during the off season or off peak times. But I think when you talk about air and in particular water, it points out to me the importance of making sure that hydro is among the list of technologies that we can rely on as renewable energies. And I know that has been bounced back and forth about whether it is or was it whether it isn't, but the ability to pump water to a higher elevation in a reservoir and then utilize it during off-peak to produce energy tells me that hydro has to be an important part of our toolbox to meet the needs. And I just wondered if your thoughts on that.
Well, I agree. I think that's what I refer to as the portfolio approach. I think having a big bulk storage capability that, quite frankly, is relevant to the whole MISO, that puts Minnesota in a good position to have economically. You're right. It's just really creating potential energy you harvest whenever you want it. Pushing water around, we have a lot of it. If you look at the idea that this company has demonstrated around the world, they're very interested in seeing the assets that Minnesota has, and they think it's just right. They specialize in brownfield sites, which is why we got interested in it as well. So.
Thank you. And fascinating stuff all the way around, so I thank everyone for your presentations today. Senator Anderson, question for you. I can personally testify to the fact that capacitors are able to store energy for a long period of time. As a former television repairman, I've been knocked off my bench stool more than once by a capacitor that has been holding energy for a long time. And it's very effective at storing a long time. When I read through here, and this one particular handout, it talks about capacitors and that they're really best used for storage, for grid stabilization to even out the rough spots on the power. And I'm wondering why capacitors aren't considered more often for another form of relatively chemical-free battery storage, because it seems like they can hold energy for a long time and release it at a rate that is predetermined by need. So,
thank you, Madam Chair and Representative. I probably don't have the technical knowledge to answer that question effectively, but I know that Professor Ned Mohan could, because I think he's made a similar point, and I think he testified here a few weeks ago. So he's a great resource at the university who can really help to make sure that answer is answered better than I can do it. But I think there's absolutely opportunity there that has yet to be explored. So, yeah.
Thank you. And may I ask one more question, Madam Chair? Thank you. And this is for Dr. Martinez. You've mentioned the fact that families that are low income are struggling frequently to pay their utility bills and often making a decision between do we heat or do we eat, and no one should have to make that decision. And I just want to, not so much a question for you, but just a statement to the committee in general, is that's one of the reasons why I'm concerned about utilizing mandates rather than allowing the market to drive the technology change, because frequently mandates will cause increase in prices for the supplies or the technology that we need. And I fear that those increased costs to the utilities will be passed on to ratepayers, who include those folks that are struggling so much to pay their bills. And so that's, you know, when you mentioned that again today, that just reminded me that is why this is so important to do it right. So thank you.
And I think, yes, and I think there are both economic, and I also want to probably stress that the economics comes in different forms, right? So there's the actual rate paying issues, but there are also very important social and health benefits, co-benefits that unfortunately we haven't incorporated into the cost evaluations of a lot of energy technologies. So obviously from a ratepayer perspective and for the most vulnerable income base, we want to make sure that any technologies are in some way
alleviating is what Ellen suggested, that it's not simply going into ratepayer relief because that's a one-time payout, but that the infrastructure of those communities is actually benefiting by either efficiency or any type of new energy technologies that can reduce their reliance on greater energy consumption. And alongside with that are the other social and health benefits. As Jim has mentioned, many of these communities, whether they're urban or rural, are going to continue to face very important resiliency issues. And so that's a long-term economic impact that can have on these communities if we're not careful, as well as some of those health impacts. So we just make sure that when we're talking about the economic impacts that we're looking at the full range of what that might be and not only the ratepayer component.
Two more questions, Representative Long and then Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll be brief. I just wanted to thank Representative Baker before he left and Representative Bowe for their points, which I think are valid, that we need to take into account the impact on low-income customers of energy prices, and just wanted to note that clean energy seems to be a way to help with that, at least in the Conexus example. They mentioned 25% savings relative to baseline of using the solar plus storage project. The example that Professor Anderson used about talking about the potential to actually have assets that folks could have who are low income that would help their energy costs over time and not just be where we need to provide them energy assistance year after year seemed to be pretty appealing. But I wanted to, my question I think was to Dr. Martinez touched on a little bit. I wanted to ask Mr. Staples, you live in North Minneapolis, what are some of the health impacts that you see in your community? I have heard, for example, that asthma rates are much higher in North Minneapolis. What are some of the health impacts that your community is feeling right now that might be alleviated by clean energy?
Well, clean energy would obviously help to clean up the air. We know that there are a variety of different contributing factors. In terms of how we get there, I think it's important that energy storage be a key component. I think it's imperative. We live right next to the HERC plant, which is the Hennepin County resource. I don't know what the C stands for, but it's where they burn trash, and that's for heat, right? I mean, it's for electricity or heat or whatever it is. At the end of the day, it's negatively impacting our community, and we need to find different ways of producing and storing power.
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Former Senator Anderson. Representative Purcell and I were about 10 years ago tried to do the solar, tried to use the energy replacement money and met great resistance. So hopefully in 10 years something has changed or you have your work cut out for you in front of you. Representative Baker had to step out, but I was going to reassure him that the cost of most of this won't be a real problem because most of all the development costs will be put onto the XL Energy ratepayers through XL Energy. And then when it's all said and done, and my constituents have paid for it, and many of the other members at this table have paid for it, it will be rolled out to greater Minnesota.
With that, I don't see
any. I just wanted to keep up consistent from last year's Energy Committee.
I don't see any other questions. I really appreciate thank you, Senator Anderson, for organizing today. And thanks to all the testifiers for coming and helping us think through some new issues.
Thank you so much for the opportunity to be here today and the great discussion. We appreciate it.
With that, the meeting's adjourned.